You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Brexit rolls on. We'll find out why the UK may actually already be backtracking on its rhetoric on leaving before the doors even shut behind it. My guests Robin Lustig and Alessio Patilano will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Tillerson in Turkey.
Today's conversation's built on three mutual long-term goals: working together to defeat Daesh, ISIS, building stability in the region, and bolstering economic ties between our two nations.
We'll find out what was on the table when the US Secretary of State met the Turkish President earlier today. We'll also discuss Chinese-US relations and discuss what Taiwan has to do with them. Plus, Madeira or bust, why a new statue at the Portuguese territory's airport is dividing opinion. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Robin Lustig and Alessio Patilano. Robin Lustig is a journalist and broadcaster. Alessio Patilano is a lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Welcome to you both. The UK's letter to the European Union announcing its exit from the Union is already raising problems for future negotiations over the next 2 years, and we're only one day in. Figures in Brussels have accused UK Prime Minister Theresa May of using Britain's stake in the security of the continent as a bargaining chip in the negotiations. The letter said, in security terms, a failure to reach agreement would mean our cooperation in the fight against crime and terrorism would be weakened. Robin, is this, as some in Brussels have said, blackmail?
Well, when in doubt, look at the Sun newspaper headline, which put it very brutally this morning: your money or your lives. That was the hidden subtext of what Mrs. May said. I understand why she said it. When they were putting that letter together, they all got round the table in Downing Street and they said, what cards do we have to play? What is it that we have that the EU still want? And they came up, quite rightly, with security and intelligence. UK's quite good at that sort of thing. So they kind of said, well, if we suggest to them that unless they're nice to us on terms of exit, some of this may be at risk, well, that is the card we can play. It's blown up in their face. Day one, and tempers are already fraying. It's not a good sign, is it?
It's not. But what's striking about this, Alessio, is that when you actually think of it, this has to be a bluff, because quite aside from the fact that France and Germany will still be Britain's neighbours and friends, also many of the EU states, another 21 of them, are also members of NATO. The idea that Britain is going to refuse to pass on intelligence to a NATO ally because of a bad trade deal is nonsensical, surely.
No, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, here the question is, I think the idea of the bluff is a very good one, in the sense that she's placing the whole sort of topic under the bigger umbrella of security. But really, what would be affected in the relationship through the EU is everything that has to do with Europol and the sharing of intelligence, insofar as, if you want, intra-European management of potential terror threats, criminals. We're not talking about hard security here. We're talking about intelligence and police cooperation on what is more, I would call, elements of security, of domestic security, of policing activity, constabulary activities, as it were, rather than the question of defence. Because in terms of hardcore defence, NATO is still the standard reference for Britain as well as for the rest of Europe in that sense.
And also, Robin, you know, this works both ways. Yes, Britain might be very good at security and intelligence, but Britain has also been the recipient of information from its allies in Europe on a constant basis.
Of course. And in a sense, this whole discussion does epitomise the nonsensical nature of this negotiation, because it's not a negotiation between equals. This is the UK saying to the EU, we've decided to leave. And the EU, in effect, as Donald Tusk, the Council President, said yesterday, will in effect just say, well, sorry about that, goodbye. So the UK has somehow to give the impression that it's got some bargaining chips, that it's got something to negotiate with. The reality, I think, is that it doesn't. And the fact that it's come up with this is just a sign of that.
Well, there's an argument, isn't there, that actually, you know, it does have some chips in that, yes, the remainder of the European Union is a market of 440 million people is far bigger than the UK at 60 million. But the UK is a large economy. It's the, you know, arguably the second largest in the Union at the moment. And a good deal that works for both sides is also in Europe's interests as well, isn't it?
Yes, up to a point. But if there isn't a deal, it hurts the UK much more than it hurts the EU. And everybody knows that. So, as I say, it's not a negotiation between equals. It's a negotiation in which I think the UK has an extraordinarily weak hand, and it's going to get very bad-tempered as this becomes more and more evident.
I think there is also a question of precedent to consider. If you come out of that negotiation with the UK getting a very good deal and sort of having the cake and eat it, as it were, or at least giving that perception across Europe, then why shouldn't everybody else sort of move away from the Union, then sort of making the whole process almost redundant, if not irrelevant? So I think here, the EU, you're absolutely right. There is a natural sort of place whereby both sides can be happy about it. But I suppose that from a European perspective, you cannot in any possible way on this particular point in time and at these early stages make it look like that is the easy way to go, because otherwise you're sending the very, very wrong message across Europe that actually leaving the Union can be a better deal than being part of the Union, which in any case I don't think it is the case.
It's striking, Robin, that so much of this debate now is about trade and a trade deal, when actually the European Union membership of it is about so much more than simply being in the single market.
But of course, for the UK, going right back to when it joined what was then the common market, it was about trade. The UK has never really, in its heart, believed in the political project, the idea of an ever closer union. It has seen it always far and away as a trade relationship. I think the other thing that we need to note from the way in which this debate has already disintegrated is that what Mrs. May said, among other things, in her letter yesterday was that she wants to discuss at the same time the terms of exit and the future relationship. Well, Angela Merkel has said quite clearly, first of all, we talk about you going. Once we've settled that, that's when we talk about the future relationship. Talks about talks are always what bedevil negotiations, and we're already in rows about talks about talks.
Alessio, are you surprised that there hasn't been more discussion so far from the UK side about the areas of European cooperation where Britain would still like to be involved in some way? And now, Theresa May has made clear that she doesn't want Britain to be able to, you know, she's not going to cherry pick, you know, certain parts, certain advantages of being in the EU. But, for example, being part of Europol may well still be in Britain's interests. Being privy to the Open Skies Agreement may actually be very good for Britain's aviation industry. But we haven't heard much of that yet.
No, and I think part of the reason is because if you take them individually, if you box them out and you compartmentalise each issue, you will see that on balance there are more issues where it could be a good deal to actually maintain a close relationship than issues where it isn't a good deal to keep a close relationship. However, where we are at this particular point in time, because the UK has a weaker bargaining position, you cannot isolate the issues and say, like, well, we'd really like to keep this one on the plate, because you don't know if that could be a bargaining chip towards sort of counterbalancing, if you want, areas where you are weaker.
I think that's right. There are things that the UK wants to talk about. There are things that the other EU countries want to talk about. They don't coincide very much. I was looking earlier today through a list of what each of the 27 remaining members of the EU regard as important in these negotiations. And they all have different priorities. This isn't three-dimensional chess. This is 27-dimensional chess. It is ferociously complicated. And I really can't see any way in which progress is going to be made. So sufficient progress is going to be made within the two-year time frame. A 10-year transitional arrangement, maybe, and that maybe if there's goodwill on all sides, we can get there. But at the moment, it's not looking great.
Have you said so, though? Perhaps there's one area where we know there's been some sort of discussion, and certainly the UK has been relatively vocal about it, and that is really maintaining close ties insofar as dealing with terrorist threats and challenges coming from the circulation across Europe and sort of monitoring people of interest to the security services. This is the one area, and even the article today that were covering this reference to security were making this quite clear. The chiefs of MI5 and MI6, they've been quite clear about the fact that their working relationship with European counterparts, they're not thinking about it as something that is going to dissolve overnight once the separation is agreed upon. And I think quite rightly so, because this is one of the achievements and really is what makes some sort of European context stand out insofar as the managing that kind of challenge, especially when you compare it to other regions of the world or even to the United States. So the ability across sort of borders to cooperate in that has been a very important point so far. It's something that is clearly understood in the security services and clearly will be at the very top of the agenda of things that...
But some of the institutional structures are going to have to change, aren't they? I mean, things like the European arrest warrant and so on. If the UK is not part of the EU, then that will have to be renegotiated.
Absolutely.
And each time it's renegotiated, there will be an opportunity for disagreements, for different priorities. It's madness.
Robin, I want to see if you can cast your mind forward a few years. I think, as we've been discussing, the idea that all this can be sorted in 2 years is perhaps slightly hopeful. It's quite possible, probably even, that deadline, which is arbitrary, is extended by some stage. But I wonder politically what happens if a deal is hard to strike, because it's all very well the experts, those who are involved, saying, well, look, if this takes another 3 years, it takes another 3 years, we need to do this properly. But it may well be that a government finds in 4 or 5 years' time, Britain still hasn't left, these negotiations with those pesky Europeans are still going on, and you have a possibly resurgent UKIP saying, I thought Brexit meant Brexit, we should have been out by now. You can see there being the hardest of hard Brexits as a Prime Minister just thinks, I just need to pull the plug and say, we're off.
I have had, ever since last June, the referendum, an optimist and a pessimist inside my head yelling at each other about how this is going to pan out. The optimist voice in my head says the EU is good above all else at fudging things, at finding ways out of problems. The Greek financial crisis was going to be the end of the EU. Somehow they got through it. Then there was Italy, was going to be the end of the EU. Somehow they got out of it. The optimist in me says somehow they will find a way out of this. The pessimist in me says this is a serious threat to the future of the EU, because if the UK leaves on anything that can be perceived, as Alessio has said, as good terms, then others will want to go the same way. There's also a very real risk that tensions will rise to such an extent that the threat of war will re-emerge on the European continent, starting in the Balkans. We have seen what has happened there within the last 20 years. We also know from our history books what happened there in the years leading up to 1914. The pessimist in my head says that is a path down which we have started and it could end very badly.
Okay, let's move on that pessimistic note. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been in Ankara today to meet with Turkish President Tayyip Recep Erdogan and his Prime Minister, his Foreign Minister. The topics on the table included how the two nations can cooperate in the fight against ISIS, but Erdogan has expressed frustration with the US over its willingness to partner with Kurdish militias in the region, which Turkey views as a hostile force. Alessio, this has been a problem for some time for the US in dealing with Turkey when it comes to the fight against ISIS. Erdogan made it very clear that he wanted President Bashar al-Assad to go. Then ISIS became the big threat. Then he said, well, I'm only helping you with the fight against ISIS if you help me with the fight against the Kurds. The Americans said no. How do you think this new American administration is going to deal with that situation?
That's a very good question, and I don't think there's a single person in the State Department that knows the answer to it, mostly because there is nobody at the State Department these days. So we've got a bit of a problem to begin with, because everything we could say is based mostly on speculation, really. And we know that most of the senior positions are not. In fact, I think that, speaking of fudging, it was quite funny. I was expecting Tillerson to be very much in an awkward position today, because he's probably not a seasoned diplomat, and this is a very complex type of question, and it simply does not have the stuff to approach it in a proper way. I don't think at the moment that there is any solution to the current stalemate. This is a stalemate that was set forth by the Obama administration, particularly as the Erdogan sort of regime turned much more rigid, and less, if you want, especially after sort of the staged coup, you know, the sort of actions that have been taking place in Turkey, make it very difficult if you're in the United States to have a lenient position, if you want, towards a Turkish government these days. So at the moment, the situation is extremely complicated, but at the same time, one must understand the position that Turkey is in, because they've got still 2 million people, Syrian refugees. They've got a Kurdish component that is enormous. They had a number of attacks going. So I think at the moment, what we're going to be looking, especially in the sort of short term, is really this sort of muddling through type of attitude, until someone in the administration comes up with an idea that somehow can move this current stalemate situation forward. But again, it's not going to be easy.
Robin, America is essentially leading the fight against ISIS in Syria, working with Kurdish militias, the YPG, with Arab militias as well. But when it comes to peace talks in Syria, the Americans are out of the picture. It's the Russians, it's the Iranians, and it's the Turks who've decided, we're going to go with these guys rather than wait for you.
Indeed, and in part, that does tell us something about the way in which President Erdogan regards Washington. He does not regard them as a crucial part of that equation. I mean, part of the imbalance we see, I think, is that President Erdogan knows exactly what he wants. Mm. He wants to make sure that the Kurds do not represent a threat to the national cohesion of Turkey, and he wants to make sure that whatever happens in Syria does not represent a threat to Turkey. He also wants more power. The referendum coming up in a couple of weeks' time, which will give him far more power than the current constitution has. If he wants anything from the United States apart from stop being nice to the Kurds, he wants them to hand over Mr. Gulen, the man who is resident in the US and whom Erdogan blames for all that is bad in Turkey. So you've got a Turkish government which knows exactly what it wants, and a US government which, even before the change of administration, was extremely confused about what it wanted. So at the moment, I would have thought game to Mr. Erdogan.
It's interesting, isn't it, Alessia, that in the West, Turkey is often described as the bridge between East and West, and it's because of its where it's placed geographically, the fact that, you know, part of it is in Asia, part of it is in Europe. And yet, certainly until recently, you talk to people in Turkey and they say, well, don't be silly, we're very much of the West. We've been in NATO since the 1950s. We have the second largest army in NATO. We were opposed to the Soviet Union. Do you think we're seeing a shift in recent years under Erdogan from Turkey seeing itself as part of the West to seeing itself, particularly since the EU has made it abundantly clear it doesn't want it as part of the EU, as more of a unaligned nation?
I think it depends on the level of analysis we're placing ourselves. As in, if we're looking at the institutional level, the bureaucratic level, the people that are the makeup, if you want, of Turkish bureaucracy, I think they're very much part of the West still. Maybe, you know, after the purges, that's a slightly different question. But if you want, the Turkish military, Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you know, the top diplomats, the top officials, they all interacted or been trained in either Europe or the United States. I personally have a considerable number of senior officers in Turkish military friends. You know, they've all spent years either here in the UK or in the United States. So they very much sort of fall under that first category that you highlighted. Then you've got a second element of the story, and that is the impact that the sort of emerging or the changing relationship between Turkey and the EU has had an impact over the wider sort of public perception of Turkey. And de facto, you're absolutely right. The general public perception is changing. If you go to places like Istanbul, Ankara, you get a feel that these are very modern, upbeat, dynamic places like any other major capital in Europe. But then when you go around and you start talking to people, the impression you have is that they are starting to draw a much greater distance between themselves and the Europeans, partly because of that discussion. And I think you got the third layer, which is the current political regime in Turkey, whereby obviously, especially since last year, we've seen a terrible shift in terms of moving away from that political, liberal, democratic sort of tradition that had been emerging in the last few years.
I remember being very struck on a visit to Turkey some years ago when I spent some time in central Anatolia, in very poor, very rural part of the country, from which Erdogan got much of his early support. Those people there did not think of themselves as Western, and they did not think of the West as being particularly well disposed towards Turkey. They thought of themselves as Turks, and they thought of themselves very much as Muslims. Mm. And Erdogan came to power with their support, in part at least as a reaction against the military and political establishment, which was emotionally and culturally closer to the West. So it is a very diverse nation. And I think part of what we saw during the attempted coup, if that's what it was last year, was these two bits of Turkey clashing on the streets of the cities. Mm. For the moment, and probably for the foreseeable future, President Erdogan is in charge and is getting more and more power in his hands. And that, in a sense, lessens the political ties, I would have thought, to the West.
Okay, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. When we return, we'll be talking about Donald Trump's upcoming meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's Bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Robin Lustig and Alessio Pasolano. Next week, US President Donald Trump will meet his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Florida, of all places. But this week, China has been less than pleased by the continued warming of diplomatic relations between the US and Taiwan. Since the middle of the last century, the US has agreed to view both China and Taiwan under the One China policy, which dictates that China and Taiwan can only have one government between them. Alessio, how much of what Donald Trump has said, or more precisely tweeted about Taiwan, is based on strategy and wanting to change the way America deals with China and Taiwan? And how much of it is just, I'm the president, I can do what I want?
I'll go for the option three, which is a mix of the two. That is, I'm the president, I do what I want, and what I want is to nail the Chinese to their economic pledges and behave differently. Said as this sound, I think that's really what at heart has been the dynamics, if you want, of Taiwan in the middle of the US-China relationship. There was a brief moment when he accepted the call as a president-elect by President Tsai that one would think that things were up for sort of discussion. And frankly, this is one of those long overdue moments of foreign policy that one should sit around the table and reassess. It's a little bit like North Korea. It's kind of stuff that we're kicking down the road at the same sort of base line assumptions, and we've done that for like decades, but they're not going anywhere. So, you know, one had a hope, but I think since then we've seen how there's been a sort of a very constrained, very sort of bottomed up type of Trump every single time he came to interact officially with the Chinese, which would suggest that he's keeping his cards close to his chest, and his game really is very much into the economic dimension, which would be supported also by the choices he's made in terms of economic advisors, rather than reviewing the position vis-a-vis Taiwan.
If one looks at what Donald Trump said about China throughout the campaign, one got the impression very clearly that to him, China represented a power that stole American jobs. It offered cheap manufacturing to companies, and American workers suffered as a result. And if one views what he says in the context of some kind of strategy, and that's a big if, but nevertheless, if one does, it's possible to suppose that he sees Taiwan as a way of attracting China's attention and saying to them, unless you do what I want on jobs and currency movements and the rest of it, I will start cozying up to Taiwan and you won't like that one bit. It's a very transactional relationship. Mm. It seems to me that one of the ways of trying to understand Donald Trump, and I appreciate how difficult that is to see him very much as negotiating a property deal every day of the week.
And that's the thing, Alessio, isn't it? Is that actually he arguably does have some leverage on the Taiwan issue, whereas actually on economic issues, it's quite tricky. He can turn around and say, oh, look, we'll put tariffs on this, and China will say, fine, mate, where are you going to get your iPhones from?
Totally. I mean, and if you look at it, last week, Boeing sort of inked an agreement to build the next generation planes in China, which really goes against the sort of logic that we're bringing jobs back to America if you really want to sort of stand by the letter of what he meant during the campaign. So Taiwan becomes, but obviously, Taiwan is the ultimate, if you want, bargaining chip where you can use that to trade, literally negotiate, to have that transaction. But if you want, this is also the saddest part of this, because Taiwan is about, if you want, those principles and values that permeate at one level American foreign policy, that are about promoting democratic values. You know, Taiwan is, for anyone who's been to Taipei, and I've been to Taipei a number of times, what is striking is that a vibrant, liberal, intellectually sort of dynamic place. And so seeing all of that reduced to an element of transaction, it's of a sadness that defies belief.
This meeting between Trump and Xi is going to be a real test of Donald Trump's diplomatic skills, because he's going to have to choose his words with care. He's going to have to read some briefs, because President Xi will be listening very, very carefully, not only to what he says, but to what he tweets the following morning. And he's going to have to watch his tongue.
Well, that's the thing that strikes me about this, is that in a sense, yes, he has offended Britain. He offended Angela Merkel pretty much when she was sat next to him and stood next to him. He's annoyed the Australians in a phone call. But actually, weirdly, with China, he might actually have to be far nicer, Alessio, face to face than he has been with his so-called allies.
Oh, totally. And you get already a sense of this. As I said, every single formal interaction between the president and his Chinese counterparts so far has been stunningly composed and really constrained. It's like, you were looking at someone like, this is not Donald Trump or the usual Donald Trump. And I think that's because he understands at one level that he needs to put up his best game when he meets Xi, if he doesn't want to sort of see the situation quickly running out of his hands.
I think I'm right in saying that one of the things we learnt immediately after the election last November, when Donald Trump and Barack Obama had their first sit down together at the White House, I think it emerged from that the one thing that Obama said to Donald Trump was, watch North Korea. Hmm. That is going to be very high in your in-tray most mornings. And it's possible to imagine that actually struck home with Donald Trump, and that he almost remembered that. North Korea is a huge problem, and China obviously is a key to it.
But that's the thing, Alessio, very briefly on North Korea. When Rex Tillerson was in China, Donald Trump tweeted that that North Korea has been playing with us and that China's been letting them. He's been very, very critical on Twitter of China and North Korea. Do you see something in the next 15 seconds before we finish that might be different when they're face-to-face?
He will probably try to. That was to stage the platform for him to have that conversation. Whether he's going to get out of it something, that's a different question.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were going to talk about Ronaldo and his bust, but never mind. You've read enough about that over the last couple of days, so it's fine. Robin Lustig, Alessio Patisolano, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Naomi Joseph. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next. Then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, 2200 here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Midori House, back to tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.